Words Appear, an Apple original. A Wish Art Films production. Water showers into lit-up reflecting pools.
Hi, Boston Center TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York.
On September 11, 2001, America came under attack.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise.
Killing thousands of Americans, more than we lost at Pearl Harbor. This was an act of war.
I felt very much that we had indeed seen the face of evil.
This was a well-organized attack to severely damage our country.
This just into our newsroom, a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center.
It was a defining 24 hours that shaped a presidency, the country, and the world.
We never had a crisis quite like this.
Of course we all were hurting. We all were terrified.
Blurry footage shows an airplane colliding with the World Trade Center.
20 years on, those at the heart of government relive an historic day.
That 747 is not looking right.
Every plane had become a missile.
They're coming after Washington. One of the targets might well be the White House.
With every minute of this extraordinary day captured,
the inner sanctum of the inner sanctum, and the pilot is worried that someone could try to conduct an inside job and take down Air Force One.
An exclusive new interviews.
We're watching on TV. There was nothing that could be done from the center of power, the greatest power on Earth.
We needed to move the president. He could be a sitting duck.
This is the story of 9/11, as has never been told before.
Did we miss something? Could we have connected the dots better? 3,000 people died on your watch. By definition, you didn't do enough.
America's under attack. And I'm watching a child read.
The one emotion that came harder and harder for him to keep in check was anger.
You know, the first plane was an accident, the second one was an attack, and the third one was a declaration of war.
Several images show former President George W. Bush aboard Air Force One and in the Oval Office. A title appears, 9/11, inside the president's war room. Under a pre-dawn sky, waves gently lap against an indigo shore. September 11th, 2001. 6:40 a.m., Longboat Key, Florida. Wearing a t-shirt bearing the slogan, Austin, Race for the Cure, George Bush jogs with two other men.
Hey, just warming up. Come on, Stretch. Come on. Come on, Stretch.
Come on, Stretch, let's go.
Richard Keel, reporter, Bloomberg.
That was his nickname for me. And so I put down my cup of coffee and I guess my notepad and took off and caught up with him and off we went.
He runs a 5K in 22 and a half minutes?
Mm-hmm. It was really a surreal experience. There was a Secret Service agent running right behind us and another on a bicycle with a submachine gun in front of us.
Andy Card, White House Chief of Staff.
Stretch Kyle Bush found out had been an NCAA All-American cross-country runner. And then I can't believe I invited him to go running for me. And the Bushes are very competitive. They don't let the grandkids beat them at checkers. So here he is inviting somebody who he thinks is going to beat him running on the golf course. And that's what he was preoccupied with.
They return from the run.
How far did you go altogether?
4.5.
4.5 miles?
Well, he spurred me on to new heights. I knew he'd come back and brief you all, so.
Yeah, he held his pace from the moment we left.
Thank you, sir.
Are we talking about tax cuts?
Not right now.
I remember saying to him, when you get back from the run, we'll do the CIA briefing, and then we're going over to the Emory Book of School, and it should be an easy day.
8 a.m., Lower Manhattan.
It's Tuesday, September 11th, primary day, and the polls are open in New York City.
As Hurricane Aaron remains well offshore, we'll have sunshine today.
Ann Compton, correspondent, ABC News.
What I remember most about the morning of September 11th, it was absolutely spectacular weather. Warm, not humid, skies were clearer. You know, that kind of good weather gives everybody a little burst of energy.
Traffic whizzes by.
You know, one of those late summer days. Humidity of August is gone. It doesn't yet feel like fall. I never sit around, am in weather like that where I don't think back to that day.
The Twin Towers stand tall across the New York skyline. Pixelated air traffic control transcripts appear on a screen.
Good morning, American 11 with you, passing through 190 to 230.
Dick Cheney, Vice President of the United States.
On 9/11, I was in my office at the White House initially, taking a briefing from the CIA. There had been a report that Al-Qaeda was getting ready to do something. I don't think the intelligence was sufficient specificity at that point that you could say, well, this is what they're going to do.
American 11, climb, maintain a level 350. American 11, Boston. This is Boston. I turned American 20 left and I was going to climb. He will not respond to me now.
In that summer, I think people described it as a summer of chatter of 2001. We had a supervisor's meeting scheduled for 10 o'clock that morning. And one of the things on my agenda for agent safety purposes was to say, hey, if you're flying with your family, one of the intel things that's coming up are hijacking, so just be aware of what's out there, you know.
Tony Zotto, Vice President's Secret Service Detail.
Is that American 11 trying to call?
We have some planes. Just stay quiet and you'll be okay. We're returning to the airport.
American 11, are you trying to call?
The flight deviates from its path.
While American Airlines Flight 11 has just been hijacked, in Florida, the president heads to an elementary school after receiving his daily intelligence briefing.
There was nothing out of the ordinary in the briefing. There were certainly no threat assessments.
There was absolutely nothing in the briefing about terrorism. But Al-Qaeda, by far, was the number one issue that was covered in those sessions. There was no clarity about where or when or how, just a lot of chatter about something big about to happen.
Michael Morrill, President CIA Intelligence Briefer, 8:47 a.m.
AP Network News, I'm Rita Foley. A plane apparently has crashed into the World Trade Center in New York. We go live now to New York and our Robin Walensky. Robin, what can you tell us?
Smoke is billowing out of the building from the upper floors of Tower 1. You can see the smoke for miles and miles. The plane actually seems to be in the building.
We turned on the televisions in the Solicitor General's office. The commentary was confused. People did not know what had happened. When they did speculate that it was an airplane, they speculated that it maybe was an accident.
Theodore B. Olson, United States Solicitor General. People evacuate the site.
My wife, Barbara, had boarded a plane that morning. She put off her trip from September 10th because my birthday was September 11th, and she wanted to wait one more day. I began to have this sense of dread. What about her airplane? Where is that plane?
Shaky footage shows smoke billowing from the North Tower.
As the presidential motorcade approaches the school in Florida, the shocking news from New York is starting to filter through.
I don't recall it being a very long ride to the school, but on the way I called a very close friend in New York to tell him that I had just gone running with the president, and his voice sounded strange the minute he picked up the phone. And he said, a plane just hit the World Trade Center. And he said, and my brother-in-law just moved to a new office in that building. We're all trying to reach him.
Keel's eyelids flutter.
In the press van, the Secret Service agent we were with had left his two-way radio open. And over it, we heard someone say that Condoleezza Rice was waiting on a secure line to talk to the president when he got to the school. Suddenly, there was this palpable element of tension in the air.
8:54 a.m., Emma E. Booker Elementary School. Ari Fleischer, White House Press Secretary.
The president finished shaking hands and went into the holding room. There are secure phones set up in that holding room. It's protected by the Secret Service. It's set up everywhere the president goes. And Condi Rice, the National Security Advisor, was on the phone.
My assistant came in and said, a plane is at the World Trade Center. And I said, well, that's a strange accident. And I called the president.
Yeah, I thought it was pilot error. I couldn't imagine anything other than a lousy pilot getting lost, and in other words, it was an accident.
He'd been told a small twin-engine prop plane crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center. I was concerned, but I did not think of it as a national security threat. And I didn't think that it should disrupt the president's day.
First thing that comes into a Secret Service agent's mind is the president in any danger here? Is there direction of interest toward the president any way whatsoever? The decision was made that the president's not in any danger at this moment. So we decided to allow him to go on with the event.
Dave Wilkinson, president, Secret Service detail.
I remember when he came in, even as a 7-year-old, you know who the president is, right? And I remember, like, even feeling like that young, feeling like kind of like starstruck and giddy, like I'm going to Disney World or something. And I put my hand over my heart. Like, I, you know, when you think about patriotic things when you're that little, you know, you do the Pledge of Allegiance every day, and I literally put my hand over my heart.
Get ready.
King.
Get ready.
King.
Yes, King. Get ready.
I am right here at the foot of the World Trade Center. This apparently was a commuter plane.
It looks from what we're seeing that it might have actually gone through one side and out the other.
It could well have been. It hit with such force that the whole neighborhood really shook.
Joining us now on the line is an eyewitness who is in the Empire State Building. Bob Bradley, what do you see?
I saw this plane. It didn't look like it was out of control at all. It didn't look like there was any trouble at all with the plane. It didn't swerve at all. It just landed directly in the building, like he wanted to fly into the building.
Captain Deborah Lower.
It's my responsibility to verify that we have all of the proper communications established for the president. I asked my team if they could find a television.
Director, White House Situation Room.
I was calling the White House Situation Room to talk to my senior duty officer. So I was chatting with him on the handset and watched as the rest of the country was watching at 9:03 when the second aircraft impacted into the second World Trade Center tower.
A view from beneath the Brooklyn Bridge shows the second plane flying low past the Woolworth Building and other skyscrapers. At street level, a pedestrian films the aircraft crashing into the South Tower.
Oh my God!
Debris hails down to the street as flames and smoke engulf the top of the building.
Oh my God!
When the second plane hit, there was an audible gasp of air in the room. It was two realizations, right? One, the immediate death toll, and then the fact that this was an attack on America.
Men and women help injured companions as they evacuate the buildings, and first responders tend to the wounded.
The other thing going through my mind at that moment was, what are the chances of a plane coming and crashing into school where we were at?
Back at the school, George W. Bush smiles at the young students.
Ready? Smile.
Yes, smile. Sound it out. Get ready.
Smile.
What word?
Smile.
Yes, smile. Read these words.
Now, it hits me as I'm standing there next to the president that he's the only one that doesn't know the second plane has hit the building. And it seemed like an eternity. It probably only lasted 2 minutes. And that was when the chief of staff made the decision to walk in and just go ahead and whisper it in his ear.
Andy Card comes up behind me and says, second plane has hit the second tower. America's under attack. And I'm watching a child read.
I was studying him intently, and his mouth was kind of drawn and tight. For just a brief moment, there was sort of a startled look in his eyes.
You're literally seeing the mindset of the President of the United States play out on TV. Everything he thought he was about as a president is changing right in front of you. This is all happening in real time.
Dan Bartlett, White House Deputy Communications Director.
If you're leading an organization during a crisis, it's really important to set a tone and not to panic. I didn't want to, you know, lurch out of the chair and scare the classroom full of children, and so I waited.
We felt that we needed to move the president and just get him out of there. He could be a sitting duck. I mean, if somebody was able to plan flying into the Twin Towers, they were certainly able to figure out where the president was.
Eddie Marinzel, President's Secret Service Detail.
We have got to consider that this situation could escalate. So I'm pulling my guys to the left of the stage, and we are planning to evacuate the building.
Bush's gaze briefly wanders across the classroom.
This is going to become a battle with the president, I knew, because, of course, he's not going to want to leave.
The lesson of a crisis, besides projecting calm, is to say something. I mean, people all across the country just in disbelief and shock and horror. There's always a void, and into that void comes, in this case, what turned out to be a psychological tsunami.
The students put away their books.
So I got up and calmly left and went back into the holding room.
Bush stands up and waves goodbye.
The first thing I said was get the FBI director on the phone, get a line open to the vice president, get a line open to the White House Situation Room. And to Dan Bartlett, I said get some remarks written for the president.
This was a mad scramble to pull together as much information we could in order for the president to say enough to demonstrate that he's got his arms around what's unfolding. And none of us had this playbook. It's not like we, you know, there's a thing they say, okay, this is happening now. Crack this open and it's going to give you the playbook of how to deal with this. Wasn't there.
Stills show the president conversing with his team.
I asked the president, with whom would you like to speak to first? And I said, sir, I have the vice president.
And that first conversation mainly dealt with, are we going to describe it as a terrorist attack? He and I both agreed that an apparent terrorist attack. And that sort of set the stage from everything that follows from that.
To me and Dick Cheney, it was pretty obvious that this was a well-organized attack to severely damage our country.
9:16 a.m., Department of Justice, Washington, D.C.
I was in the office. My assistant came in, said, Barbara's on the phone. I was relieved she was alive. But she told me immediately that her plane had been hijacked, and then the line went dead.
This is John Thomas, ops manager. I think we need to let everybody know this right away. American 77 was just west of Charleston, West Virginia, and disappeared off our radar scope. We now believe that aircraft may have been hijacked. What with the World Trade Center, we could have another loose aircraft out there somewhere.
President Bush, he knew Barbara. She was on television just 2 days earlier defending him.
President Bush is right. Kids have got to learn to read, or they're lost. The education issue is the centerpiece of his agenda. He's got
an... And his whole leadership of his administration knew who Barbara was.
Unaware of this third hijacking, in Florida, the president and his aides are still scrambling for information about the first two attacks.
Everybody was working the phones trying to ascertain what was happening. Typically, at a time of hot breaking news, the press has access to a lot of things that the government doesn't, because the press has cameras everywhere. So what TV stations are now broadcasting on the air is really important information. A rebroadcast came on, and the president whipped around to see where Dan was pointing as the plane hit the tower. And you can feel the tension as people were stopping working the phones to look all of a sudden for the first time for us.
There was just total disbelief. And we went from a very calm, beautiful day to one in which our world changed dramatically.
9:25 a.m.
While the president absorbs the horror of the attacks in New York.
Air Traffic Control Command Center.
The crisis is escalating in America's skies.
Ben Sliney.
We took steps at that point to limit the amount of aircraft that could actually get airborne. I ground stopped everything in the country. We had over 4,000 aircraft airborne. I knew, at least I surmised, that this was not the act of a deranged hijacker, that this was a concerted action by a group of people.
As air traffic controllers deal with an unprecedented situation, a fourth plane's cockpit is breached.
United 93, that traffic for you is 1 o'clock, 12 miles eastbound, 370.
Negative contact, we're looking at United 93.
An excerpt from a transcript reads, "Hey, Mayday.
You got United 93?
It looked like he descended there.
United 93, verify 350.
Do you have United 93 south of Shark?
We hear some funny noises. We're trying to get him. Do you have him?
No.
With United 93, the latest plane to be hijacked, President Bush prepares to address the nation, still uncertain as to the full nature of the attack.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a difficult moment for America. Today, we've had a national tragedy.
The Air Traffic Command Center, the TMO on duty in the West area. I need to have all traffic management units do an inventory of all airborne traffic. Ensure that you do not have any aircraft that are not accounted for.
I had my staff ask all the facilities in the country to identify for us any aircraft that they deem suspicious. I actually considered closing the airspace at that point, but I hesitated thinking about the chaos that would ensue.
Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center.
Barbara got back on the phone, and I had to tell her about the two airplanes that had been flown into the World Trade Center. We exchanged a couple of words of affection, and the line went dead again.
At the school, Bush stands at a podium.
And now, if you join me in a moment of silence.
They bow their heads.
They got the piece down. Keep remaining sitting. We have them all aboard.
Calling Cleveland Center, you're unreadable. Say again slowly.
United 93 may have a bomb on board.
Can you give me any additional information as to why you believe there may be a bomb?
Because he's screaming that on the frequency.
Okay.
I've gone from a classroom with a child reading to believing America's under attack in a pretty brief period of time. May God bless the victims, their families, and America. Thank you very much.
Bush shares a handshake with an official and waves to the students as he leaves.
We have got to leave Sarasota and get the president to a safe place. We're going to get to the plane as quickly as we can because the safest location for the president at this time, until we know what's going on, is to get him up in the air. We immediately exited, went to the motorcade, and the call was made, we're going to go at a high rate of speed. We're going to shut the intersections down with physical barriers to make sure suicide attacks, everything is not a concern.
They speed along.
It really hit me when I was in the limousine heading out to Air Force One. I was immediately surrounded by serious protection.
We were going like the bat out of proverbial hell. And I looked to my left, and I realized we were bracketed by four police cars, two in front and two in back, sort of covering our flanks. The Secret Service said we were worried about a car bomb intercepting the motorcade, and we wanted to cause the bomb to go off 15 or 20 feet further away and give the president greater chance of survivability.
Carl Rove.
Sort of a sobering moment.
Senior advisor to the president.
With concerns growing over the president's safety, the vice president, too, now gets even closer protection.
At the White House.
The door burst open, and one of my Secret Service agents, Jimmy Scott, came in rapidly, put one hand, his right hand on my belt and back, the other hand on my shoulder, and literally picked me up and moved me towards the door.
The agent had told me that there was a plane coming in. It was unclear how far out it was, but at 500 miles per hour, it doesn't take long for something to arrive on your doorstep.
Patrick ID is coming around. Can I help you?
Latest report, aircraft VFR 6 miles southeast of the White House.
6 miles southeast of the White House?
Yep, 6 southwest.
Jimmy took me out into the hallway, down the stairs in the west wing.
The agent was instructed to take us down towards what they call the PIOC, the emergency center.
I knew Jimmy, and I knew these guys are trained, and if he's moving like that, I better follow. I didn't have much choice anyway.
The aircraft is moving away.
Moving away from the White House?
Yeah.
He's beating away. You don't have to type aircraft
because
you don't know who he is.
Nothing. Right. Awesome. So I have no clue.
There were a lot of confusion as to what was happening, a lot of confusion as to where the planes were. Part of the problem at that point was to discern what is the scope of this attack.
With an unknown plane now over the Capitol, air traffic controllers enlist a cargo aircraft, call sign Gopher 06, to try to identify it.
Gopher 06, traffic is 11 o'clock and 5 miles northbound, fast moving, type and altitude unknown.
Gopher 06, we have traffic in St. Louis.
Do you know what kind it is? Can you see?
Looks like a 757, sir.
The first item that comes to mind is they're coming after Washington, not only New York.
That traffic's still in a descent now, and looks like he's rolled out northeastbound.
You don't have time to say, oh my goodness, what's happening to us? Every plane had become a missile.
9:37 a.m., Pentagon, Washington, D.C. Frames of security camera footage show the third plane plowing into the side of the Pentagon. A fireball erupts.
Washington, this is Gopher 06.
Gopher 06, guys.
Yes, it looks like that aircraft crashed into the Pentagon, sir.
A fire truck and an ambulance arrive at the scene.
See what happened up there?
Yeah, it went in the Pentagon.
It looks like it went in the Pentagon.
Plane into the building.
I went into the Situation Room to try to reach the national security principals.
Personnel evacuate the area.
Colin Powell was in Peru for an Organization of American States meeting. They said George Tenet, the CIA director, had already gone to a bunker. And they said, we can't reach Secretary Rumsfeld. His phone is just ringing and ringing and ringing. And we looked on television, and a plane had hit the Pentagon. And then I called the president. He said, I'm coming back. And I did something I had never done before and would never do again. I raised my voice, the president of the United States. I said, stay where you are. We're under attack.
Okay, all units responding over to the Pentagon. You need to be careful, possible terrorist attack.
And it was at that moment that I realized we were at war. You know, the first plane was an accident, the second one was an attack, and the third one was a declaration of war.
Oh my goodness. We're looking at a live picture from Washington, and there is smoke pouring out of the Pentagon.
I'm sitting in a government office 2 miles from the Pentagon. I knew what was coming, and then I saw it, and then I knew that my greatest fears were true. That had to be the American Airlines plane that Barbara was on.
We don't know whether this is the result of a bomb or whether it is yet another aircraft that has targeted a symbol, the United States power.
It was a helpless feeling that this incomprehensible thing had happened to this country. It was a dreaded sense of horror.
A chopper flies past billowing plumes of smoke and lands near the crash site.
When I got word that American 77 had struck the Pentagon, that's when I shut down everything. The order was to land all aircraft at the nearest airport, regardless of their final destination.
Stand by, everybody stand by. This is Command Center. The Command Center request, as soon as possible, they want all aircraft on the ground. All aircraft, regardless of destination, land as soon as possible.
That was the last step that I could take to get control of the airspace. I felt, well, if we get everyone out of the air, we'll be able to deal with the few that are left. I couldn't imagine there would be that many left. That may be a problem.
It would appear now that perhaps this nation is under attack from some unknown source.
I would say without question.
We're looking at pictures here now, looking at Washington. We're seeing from the Executive Office Building, which is being evacuated now along with the White House, we're seeing columns of smoke across the river at the Pentagon rising.
I remember it just looked chaotic watching it from home. And I knew I had to get to the office, but I didn't know how to get there. They were shutting down downtown Washington. And I was on the phone with my chief of staff, who ran my office at the White House. And she said, Karen, I've got to go. They're telling us to run. And I said, well, then go.
The assumption was that one of the targets might well be the White House. And the Secret Service told everybody to evacuate.
Everybody back.
Now let's go. Move it out.
The real thing, let's go.
The intensity and the volume of the voices kept escalating. The calls for us to get moving, to get out, to get out.
Jennifer Miller Weiss, White House Assistant Press Secretary.
Scatter, scatter, please go home.
And I remember making eye contact with a woman who was part of the Secret Service, and I remember her screaming at me, take off your heels and run.
That 747 is not looking right. 12 o'clock high. He's turning hard. Shit.
Mary Madeline, counselor to the vice president.
The streets of Washington, there were cars stopped in the middle of the road, still running, doors open. People were running everywhere. There was smoke. It was Mad Max.
Officers hurry down a street, and a fire truck rushes by.
As America's skies close for the first time in U.S. history, and fear grips the Capitol, a further threat now causes concern for the president's safety.
As we arrived at the airport, we began to get intel that Air Force One could be a target.
A limo drives Bush to the runway.
There could be someone at the end of the runway that could be a threat. Someone with a Stinger missile, or some kind of high-powered rifle even.
A police dog sniffs through luggage.
There was an incredible push to get everybody on the plane as quickly as possible. They are yelling at us, move it, move it, move it, to board more quickly.
I do remember actually feeling scared as I ran up the steps and having the disjointed thought. I've never been scared being with a president before.
Bush strides up the steps to Air Force One and turns to give a short wave.
I remember some of the Air Force personnel greeting me at the door, and they were shaken badly.
The door is sealed shut.
So Colonel Tillman said to me, I can turn around and fly the other direction, but it'll be the steepest takeoff you will ever see a 747 take, and you need to make sure the president's sitting down. I said, I'll take care of that. Just do it.
The decision was made to go ahead and rotate to counter the threat at the end of the runway and do max perform the aircraft. So we used full power. The plane was extremely light, minimal passengers. The goal was to get airborne, move away fast.
My seat was 20 yards or so away, and I'm standing there, and I'm the only one who's not seated with a seatbelt. So I'm standing there with the president, and the engines just screamed, and we were screaming down the runway. And I'm going, this is unbelievable. The plane doesn't take off like this. And I put my foot against the president's desk and my backside against the bulkhead and just pressed myself in there. The president, he leaned over with his arm. And we were taking off at an angle that I never want to experience again. I went partially weightless. I mean, I was petrified.
Air Force One takes to the skies.
It was a very emotional experience for everybody. I tried to be cool, calm, and present, but some people were hyperventilating or, boy, what are we going to do? And kind of contagious with fear. And I didn't want that to infect the decision-making process that the president was going to have to go through. So we did keep some people away.
I was just trying to gather information so I could then begin to make rational decisions.
The president said to me, I want you to call George Tenet, the director of CIA, my boss, and I want you to tell George that I want to be the first to know if he learns anything about who did this.
With the president desperate to learn more about the attacks, he immediately faces a new challenge.
We had real problems aboard Air Force One that day with the communications equipment. The phone that was supposed to connect the president to the vice president and others in the bunker below the White House kept conking out. I remember the president holding the phone out in endless frustration.
A TV screen flickers.
So we would not have full-time communications. TV reception. Air Force One didn't have satellite TV. And so we could get TV coverage as we would fly over cities where the ground-based antenna put out a sufficiently strong, powerful enough signal that we could pick it up at 40,000 feet in the sky.
As we're going through these different local TV zones, and it would be on, it'd be flickering, and then what was eerie about it is that it wasn't a constant picture.
the TV came on, we were all riveted to it because we were getting new, fresh information. And then as we would fly along and the signal would fade, the screen on the TV would fade to gray. Amazing to think that one of the worst places to be to get information was the place where information should have been set up by design to flow the best to the President of the United States.
Now, by chance, just 73 minutes after the attacks began, the television signal on Air Force One holds steady long enough for a picture to form.
9:59 a.m., Lower Manhattan, New York. The towers continue to burn.
Take two and two, one. This is as close as we can get to the base of the World Trade Center. You can see the firemen assembled here, the police officers, FBI agents, and you can see the two towers. A huge explosion now, raining debris on all of us. We better get out of the way!
Footage shows a cameraman's shadow as he flees. People flood the streets as they try to outrun gusts of ash and debris flowing from the collapsed South Tower. To find a dust cloud encroaching the street right behind him. He captures a fleeting shot of people scattering before a haze obscures the screen.
Those images are seared in my mind. There was no noise on Air Force One except the plane flying.
On a street, survivors stand coated in ash.
I was horrified. And it was sickening.
Stay right where you are.
Stay where you are, man.
Stay where you are.
We're all transfixed. You know, all you could do was watch in horror, and nobody said anything. And just the thought of all the deaths that could have taken place in that one instant.
A still shows Bush in his onboard office.
What I saw was a man who was doing his level best to keep all the various emotions in check.
He rests a hand against his mouth.
The one emotion that I think became harder and harder for him to keep in check was anger. This brewing of, you think you're going to get away with this?
I knew if we were under attack, my job as president was to protect the country. And, you know, I didn't know who they were yet. One thing on the to-do list was to kick their ass.
Still show Eddie Marinzel in conversation with Bush.
You know, I wanted to go home to D.C. I'm commander-in-chief. I wanted to be at the center of the action.
I said, we can't do that until we can secure the White House in D.C. We're going to have to go someplace else. There's no way we're going to take them into an unsecured area. I suggest that we go west, not east.
All of a sudden, I feel the plane turning away from northeast. And I called Andy, said, Andy, you know, let's get to D.C. He said, it's highly recommended we don't.
I told the president, we're going to go to Barksdale Air Force Base, get a little more information of what's going on. We can tape a message for the American people. They're already under an exercise, calling for them to be on their highest level of alert. But the president was adamant that he wanted to go back to Washington. He was telling me, I am the president of the United States. We are going back to Washington, D.C. And I said, you don't want to make that decision right now. I don't think you want to make that decision right now. I think we have to know more. And he said, I am making the decision right now.
I had a conversation with the president, and my recommendation was to him that he not come back yet. Washington was under attack as well as New York, and that it was important for the two of us, the president and vice president, to stay separate. Andy Card on the plane and me on the phone pretty well persuaded him, you know, not yet, because we just didn't know.
There was no doubt in my mind and in theirs that I was the commander-in-chief. That's why it was vital that I have a team of people who understand the chain of command and the role of the president. But needless to say, continuity of government became an essential element for the security forces.
We were just very happy that the president agreed not to really force the issue to go back to Washington, D.C. And that when we went to Barksdale, it would give us a chance to regroup. And we could put a plan together on what we were going to do.
And 865, we have the traffic below.
We're 56865, Cleveland Center. Roger, and I have a question for you. We have Boeing 757. Can you see him up there, sir, and tell me an altitude if that's able? Southeastbound.
We've got him. He's behind us and only about 1,000 feet above us.
There is now only one known hijacked flight remaining in the sky. Controllers track it by talking to another plane.
Okay, he's descending. He's getting closer to our altitude. We haven't been sight yet.
We're 56865. I advise you stay away from that aircraft. Go north fast as you can.
But it's not just controllers struggling with limited information. It's also those inside the White House bunker.
It was very much the fog of war. There were specific flight numbers being thrown around of flights that were of concern. We were getting regular reports about how many were still in the air, how many were unaccounted for.
Plane going here and a plane going there. I had reports that a car bomb had gone off at the State Department. There's a lot of information flying around, and a lot of it's not valid.
Okay, what's he doing now, sir? It appears that he might be turning a little to the north. Does that concur?
That's concurred. It looks like he's rocking his wings.
The principal anxiety in the bunker was how many planes were out there that had been weaponized by terrorists and were headed for other targets around the United States. And how do we deal with it? Because we had no idea.
Keeps rocking back and forth.
Norman Mineta, Secretary of Transportation.
You won't find it written in any manual what to do in a situation like this. Essentially, we were flying by the seat of our pants at that point.
I was sitting right across from the vice president when the military aide came in and reported that another flight was headed south toward Washington. It was presumed to be a hijacked flight. It turned out to be, I think, United 93. He asked the vice president for permission for military aircraft to engage.
That's when the vice president used a very military term, take the track. Everybody in the room knew what that meant. Shoot down that aircraft.
There was a silence as people absorbed the order that had just been given.
I got on the phone and talked with the president, got his approval that that's what we wanted to do.
You know, we didn't know how many more planes were in the sky, how many were hijacked. I made the decision. Was I happy about it? No. But was I comfortable in making the decision? Yes.
United 93, have you got information on that yet?
Yeah, he's down.
He's down?
Yes.
When did he land? Because we have information.
He did not land.
Oh, he's down?
Yes,
down?
Somewhere up northeast of Camp David.
One of the watch standards came in and said that the track has been eliminated. And the vice president said, the plane's down? And he said, the track's been eliminated. Vice President looked at me and he said, did we take that track? And I said, I don't know.
Lieutenant Commander Doug Cochrane.
We had every reason to believe that, in fact, we had taken down that aircraft.
As the occupants of the bunker try to establish whether United 93 has been brought down by their own actions, suddenly their focus turns again to New York.
10:28 a.m.
To look at the smoke that was coming from the city, folks stepping out of bodegas and stores to look. Now people are gathering in large groups. In fact, in one corner, I saw a group of people actually holding hands and praying. As I stand on the Manhattan Bridge, which is closed, it is open to pedestrian traffic. Some people are walking across, but there's just no way for them to. As I look out, something is. I can't. It looks as though the building is going. Is that the building going down? Is that the second building of the World Trade Center going down?
Past a view of the city's distinctive rooftop water tanks in the foreground, the distant North Tower collapses in on itself.
It didn't implode even, it just melted.
A pillar of smoke remains in its place.
My brain could not process what I was seeing.
This was a major attack on the United States. And it was pretty clear cut that this was going to be a very heavy loss of life.
That was a searing moment. We're watching on TV. There was nothing that could be done from the center of power, of the greatest power on Earth.
An officer ushers three people to an ambulance.
But from that room, we needed to figure out what we could do to help prevent anything further from happening.
At this moment of national tragedy, from Air Force One to the bunker, the government is struggling to regain control.
The communication devices down there were inept. If we had a screen, we couldn't tell what was going on outside, because if we had a visual, we had no sound. If we had sound, we had no visual. And it was terrifying. The country didn't know what was going on, and we didn't know. It's a very scary time.
The government was not well prepared for this moment. The bunker itself was antiquated. The furniture and technology were probably at least 20 years old. I remember the commander of the bunker facility pulling me aside when the oxygen in the bunker started to get dangerously low because there were too many people.
Everybody started dozing off, and I'm like, well, something is wrong here. Well, we had exhausted our oxygen, and we're breathing in our own CO2 and such. We were, like, poisoning ourselves.
We ended up having a lot of people leave, go someplace else. We didn't need you in that site.
As the administration battles with the limitations of the bunker, word of an imminent threat to Air Force One comes in and is immediately shared with the president.
There was a call that said Angel's next. And Angel was the code word for Air Force One.
A shiver goes through everybody. Who's got the code word for Air Force One? So when Air Force One's pilot, Colonel Tillman, heard about this, he posted at the base of the steps that lead up to the cockpit, Air Force security officer, with instructions that no one is to go upstairs. Think about that. Inner sanctum of the inner sanctum, and the pilot is worried that someone in the president's circle could try to conduct an inside job and take down Air Force One.
The team holds a huddle.
We're trying to figure out exactly how we could be attacked. At this point, it was to assume the worst case. Somehow we were going to be attacked airborne, so we had to be ready for it.
Once we found that the president was a target, we take no chances. We've taken all the weapons away, we believe, right? I mean, we've done everything we can too, but you never know. The president's in the front of the aircraft. You have staff and Secret Service in the center of the aircraft, and the media and all the guests are on the back of the aircraft. So we had the agents come up to the front of the aircraft and stand close to the president's cabin and make sure no one could come up to the front of the aircraft. Even your most senior White House staff members were not allowed to come up there unless the president called them up there.
As security is tightened on board, there are still real fears about an external attack.
Air Force One is filing a random route, by the way.
Okay.
We don't know where they decided to go, but they still don't have a fighter escort.
They still do not?
That's correct.
Holy cow.
A flight path shows the aircraft climbing in altitude.
In that moment, there was a bullseye on us, and we certainly don't know the scope of this entire attack. We don't know if we're in the beginning of it, the middle, or near the end of it.
Dan Bartlett smiles wryly.
Most people would say one of the safest places you'd ever feel would be with the President of the United States. It was the first time that really came under question. You're like, maybe this is not the best place to be.
Still show a fighter jet flying alongside the plane.
And then all of a sudden we get this radio call. It was flight of two F-16s, we are your cover. And you know, and that was the greatest feeling ever, because there are folks and they're coming up and they're joining on the wing.
I was kneeling on one knee, my arm on kind of the ledge beneath the windows looking out. Sure, people think that Air Force One's followed by fighter planes all the time, but very rarely in the United States.
Gordon Jandro.
And I mean...
White House Assistant Press Secretary.
That really hit home.
He blinks back tears.
It just wasn't something that, I contemplated. Why does Air Force One need a fighter escort?
Bush and the others gaze out a row of windows at the F-16.
It turns out it was a terrible series of errors. The caller never used the word angel. They said Air Force One is next. One of the intelligence officers did what came routine to them. They used the word angel and passed that down to the bunker underneath the White House where the vice president was, who passed it up to the president saying angel is next. The amount of information that is wrong when you are in a moment of crisis, the filters are down, people let information through just in case, is staggering.
Aerial footage shows a plume of smoke rising from amidst an expanse of trees.
We have a report now that a large plane crashed this morning in western Pennsylvania, a Boeing 767 jet. We don't know if this is somehow connected to what has gone on in New York and Washington.
As the public learns that a fourth plane has crashed, United 93, the administration is still trying to discover if its actions have brought it down.
I remember the vice president being on the phone with the Pentagon saying, you must know whether or not you engaged a civilian aircraft. And they kept saying, we can't confirm, we can't confirm.
Pentagon must have scrubbed that question every which way to make sure we were getting the right answer. Finally, we were told, no, we did not shoot it down.
United 93 had in fact crashed well before any shoot-down order was even issued. It was the passengers, not the government, who had confronted the hijackers.
As it turned out, the passengers on board were able to move more quickly and effectively than we could.
People rush in the cabin, sacrificing their own life to save the lives of a lot of people. And I still marvel at that kind of character.
Every time I think about it, it just makes me tear up about the sacrifice that they made that day in Shanksville.
Various responders stand scattered around a massive rift in a meadow, within which lie the smoldering remains of the crashed aircraft. Back at Ground Zero.
Jim Kallstrom, former official of the FBI in the New York office, is on the air. Jim, what do you think?
Well, my first thought is with the tremendous casualties, the death toll was just overwhelming. It's a day that 50 years from now our children will be taught about when we went to war on American soil with terrorism.
I realize, by the way, just as you mentioned it, something else is very important at the moment. Again, I don't mean to say this in melodramatic terms. Where is the President of the United States? The President of the United States led, I know we don't know where he is, but pretty soon the country needs to know where he is.
A gray haze fills the sky.
America's largest city is devastated. Its military headquarters burning. And its president, now a long way from home.
11:45 a.m., Barksdale Air Force Base.
Instead of going to D.C., we went to Shreveport, Louisiana. You know, frankly, there was some humor during this day, and one of them was when we landed, I thought we were coming out of the Dr. Strangelove set on the movie. I mean, they were having a bomber drill. So we had loaded bombers, and we're putting some kind of vehicle.
There was no armored limousine for the president, a blue Dodge minivan pulled up to take the leader of the free world to safety. I don't think I've ever seen a president of the United States ride in a minivan.
Bush gets into the blue minivan.
And there was a military driver who apparently was so scared that he just took off out of there.
We're flying down the tarmac, and I told the sergeant driver, I said, man, I don't think there's any Al-Qaeda on this base. Why don't we just take our time and get to the headquarters. That was the most danger I'd been in all day.
Later, Bush is escorted into a building.
We get to the
commander's office, and we go in there. He had very good communications. We communicated back to Washington, D.C. The conversations back are really to understand what other intelligence are we seeing? What else should we know? And are any of our enemies trying to take advantage of this?
This is a period of great uncertainty. And as we began to heighten our defenses, we wanted to make sure that the Russians understood we weren't aiming any weaponry at them.
I was concerned that the Soviets had an exercise underway that day, and we didn't want to have them misunderstand what was happening over here.
If we alert our forces and the Russians alert theirs and we alert and they alert, it's not long before you're actually at a state of war when things just start to happen.
A lot of this defense business is automatic. It's built to minimize human error, and that obviously has the tandem effect of excluding humans when they need to be inserted into the process.
So I had a phone call with President Putin, and I said, Mr. President, our military forces are going to be going up on alert. And he said, don't worry, ours will be coming down. We've canceled exercises. And I remember thinking, or almost chuckling to myself, of course you know that our forces are going up on alert. You can see it. But recognizing right at that moment that the Cold War was truly over, Putin had reacted in the right way.
At the commander's office, Bush writes on some paper.
In a crisis of this magnitude, it's essential that leadership continually try to reassure the people. And I don't think you can overdo it in the immediacy of a crisis. And so therefore, it was essential that I speak on a regular basis as we gathered facts.
He steps behind a podium.
I was looking at him with a reporter's eye, but also as an American.
I want to reassure the American people that the full resources of the federal government.
I found myself looking at his face as much as I was listening to the words. And I think that was probably true of most of the people in that room, reporters or not. I won't say he looked haunted, but the severity of what was happening registered clearly on his face.
God bless.
Bush exits the room.
Then we were off again.
Photographers disperse.
But ABC's Ann Compton is on the telephone.
We may be scrambled out of here.
Okay.
Are we leaving? Okay, Peter, we are leaving. And
where are you going, Annie?
Peter, I have no idea.
Still insisting on a return to Washington, President Bush orders a quick departure from Barksdale.
I remember getting Air Force One. I mean, they shut those doors quick. And we're airborne. I wanted to go back to Washington. And there were some objections.
He was telling me we're going back to Washington, D.C., and kind of ordering me. And I'm saying, I really don't think you want to make that decision right now. Again, which I had repeated over and over and over and over to him. Boy, he got angry with me. He got very, very angry with me.
Still show them arguing.
I might have chewed him out a little bit. But I wanted to get home. But I was being told by the security apparatus that it's unsafe.
I remember him saying, I'm not going to run from these guys. He wanted to fight. You know, he was ready to fight, right? As supervisors, you've got to be able to tell the president no. By law, Air Force One flies at the discretion of the Secret Service. So we had to explain to him, it's our job to keep the office of the President of the United States safe. And, you know, it's really not your call.
Yeah, he was fit to be tied. And he basically acquiesced more than approved.
The most important thing is that we were then able to go where we could have even better security and communication.
Off at Air Force Base is an hour and 15 minutes north, and there are facilities there that will allow us to bring together all the important officials of the government together in a secure video conference. Now, the president was not happy about this and made it clear that, you know, this was their last dodge. So quicker the better.
a shroud of black smoke obscures the New York skyline.
How the president now spends his time today, what he is seen to do, is absolutely vital, not just to the country, but to him.
Well, it's critical time for him. He said that the nation is being tested. The new president is being tested as well. The main thing he has to do for most Americans is communicate to them that he's in charge, that he intends to take control of this situation, and as he said, hunt down the people who are responsible for it and punish them.
In Times Square, pedestrians stare at footage on a billboard.
I saw how America is reacting, and, I'm really not a very angry person. But I was angry that people killed Americans. But you can't make rational decisions when you're angry. As president, it's really important you don't decide till you fully understand the environment and the facts.
The president asked to see me in his office alone, he said. The president then looked at me and said, Michael, who did this? I told him that I had not seen any intelligence that would take us to a perpetrator, so he was going to get my best estimate, right? Not finally analyzed intelligence. And he said, I understand the caveat, now move on. It's a very kind of George Bush thing to do. So I said, Mr. President, there are two nation states who have the capability of doing this, Iran and Iraq. But neither one of them has anything to gain, so I don't think it was one of them. I told him that I thought when we got to the end of the trail, we would find Al-Qaeda and we would find bin Laden. And I told him, Mr. President, I am so confident in that I would bet my children's future on it. Then he just sat there for almost 5 minutes.
Bush sits looking aside with a hand covering his mouth.
My job changed. Let me rephrase that. My job became crystal clear. I thought, if it's Al-Qaeda, what do we need to do to bring them to justice?
2:50 p.m. Air Force One lands at Offutt Air Force Base, Nebraska.
When we got to Offutt, one of the first things the president said is, I want to go back to Washington right now. So the idea was, let's go down into the bunker, get briefed. But it was on his mind from the moment he arrived, I want to go back to Washington.
Ann Compton, who's been with the president all day, is on the phone from Nebraska. We don't want to lose her if we can have her. Annie, can you hear me?
Yes, Peter, I can.
What are you doing in Nebraska?
Well, we didn't know where we were till we landed. President Bush is here at the home of the Strategic Command. And he has disappeared down the rabbit hole, Peter, down through a red brick small building down into an underground bunker where the president is going to chair a National Security Council meeting by teleconference.
Here he was at Offutt Air Force Base, and all of this was going on, and he couldn't get back, and he was really kind of caged. That was the sense I had of his frustration. He couldn't be where he needed to be.
Throughout the morning, the moves to protect the president have compromised his access to information. But now, 75 feet underground, and 6 hours since the first plane struck, he finally receives up-to-date intelligence.
George Tenet was on the screen and was briefing the president about information that we had uncovered just in the last few hours.
Did we know it was Al-Qaeda? We thought we did. The CIA director confirmed that we did.
George said, we know that Al-Qaeda did this. He said, Mr. President, we'll confirm in the morning, but we know. And the president said, how do you know? And that was when George said those manifests had people who were on our watch list.
A cursor highlights names on a digital manifest.
The president turned around and looked at me, and I could tell by the look on his face that he was saying, I thought I told you that I wanted to be the first to know. And it was a look of disappointment in me.
Karen Hughes, counselor to the president.
President Bush practically came through the television screen, and he said, we are at war against terror, and from this day forward, this is the priority of our administration. That was the first thing he said to all of us.
I did need to make sure that they knew who was in charge. I'm not suggesting anybody was peeling off, but teams function better when the leader, in this case, asserts himself. And I wanted them to know that we needed a plan to deal with it and that everybody had a role to play.
I remember him saying to the FBI director, your job just changed. You're accustomed at the FBI to catching the bad guys after a crime is committed. Your job is now to prevent the terrorists from launching another attack.
I called George Tenet's executive assistant, and he told me the information that CIA had developed on Al-Qaeda that day was embargoed from leaving the building. And I said, in a very loud voice and with some swear words, embargoed from the President of the United States? Long pause at the other end. And I said, just send it to me right now. And I slammed the phone down.
Stills show the video conference in session.
The president specifically asked George if he thought there would be more attacks. And George Tenet told the president, I think we're done for today.
When the president had heard all the information that he was presented and he was done asking questions, he stood. He slapped his hand on the table, and he says, we're going home.
Air Force One waits on the tarmac.
I decided to go back to Washington. The idea was to give a speech to the nation. And, giving a speech to the nation from a bunker in the middle of Nebraska was not my vision of leadership. I said, if I'm going to give a speech to the nation, it's going to be from Washington, D.C., and I'm coming home.
A clip shows Bush standing in a cabin hallway.
On the way back, the president came back on Air Force One, stopping first in the Secret Service cabin, thanking them, patting him on the shoulder. And he stopped at the door to the press cabin. He waved away our reporters' notebooks, didn't want to be quoted. And he said, we're going to get those thugs. And I'm looking out the window of Air Force One, and it's this beautiful golden afternoon. And there was this sense that the worst is over.
It was a day full of a lot of sadness. And I knew that Mother and Dad would be worried about how I was feeling. And I finally found them. And Mother got on the phone. And I said, Mother, where are you, by the way? She said, we're outside Milwaukee. And I said, you got to be kidding me. What are you doing there? She said, you grounded our plane. And so, it's typical mother. And was I concerned about him? You bet. But once I knew they were safe, I was fine.
He reclines as he reads a document.
The president felt a sense of relief, a sense of, I'm excited to get back to Washington. I think a lot of folks felt a sense of relaxation that it was over. And I felt like, I don't know if we really know what's going on, right? I mean, we feel that way, that it's over. We do have the escorts from the F-16s, but do I really know the whole terrorist event's over?
The concerns of the Secret Service deepen when new intelligence suddenly emerges, raising tensions again.
The team holds another meeting.
Flying back, CIA headquarters securely faxed a package of materials to Air Force One. There was a piece of intelligence that had been provided to us by a European intelligence service that said that what happened that morning was the first of two waves of attacks against the U.S. homeland.
Was this all part of their plan to get us back to Washington so that the second wave couldn't happen?
The president had just gone through the worst attack on the United States in American history. And here his intelligence briefer was showing him a piece of intelligence that suggested that there might be a second wave coming at us. He didn't say anything that suggested that this hit him hard, but I could tell just by the look on his face.
I spent a lot of time worrying about further attacks, a lot. We felt pretty secure. And all of a sudden, a group of killers that was able to penetrate our so-called defenses and kill 3,000 people in one moment's notice.
Bush speaks on the phone while his team huddles.
As the prospect of further attacks occupies the president,
5:20 p.m.,
the effects of the initial strikes continue to unfold. A third building in the World Trade Center complex is in danger of collapse.
The third World Trade Center building sinks to the ground.
Shit! But there are people down there.
Fresh clouds of smoke billow from the site.
The third World Trade Center building has now collapsed. A 47-story building number 7. CBS News correspondent Cammie McCormick is there.
Suddenly everyone started screaming. People started running, panicking, because it looked like just a wall of dust coming for us.
The fear on the streets of New York is matched by the mood of many aboard Air Force One.
I think just based upon the unknown, I did have a few moments of real concern that I would never see my family again.
Nodding, Lower purses her lips.
Precautions were being taken on many levels that had me, and I'm sure others, concerned that we might not make it through the day.
I remember Colonel Dick Tubb, who is the White House doctor, kind of went around all of us and was giving us these, you know, pills.
I looked at him, I said, Doc, what's this? And he says, it's Cipro, just take it. Cipro is prophylactic against anthrax, but we had to be ready for everything.
So I take the pills. I kind of looked around and I said, I didn't see anybody else take all the pills. And so I looked down and I picked it up, and it says, take one pill each day for the next 7 days. I'd just taken all of them. And I sat to myself and I went, you dumb SOB. You just killed yourself. I literally thought I'd just killed myself. Obviously, I came out the other end of this okay. And so it became a recurring joke about me attempting to OD on Air Force One on 9/11.
On board, they watched the news.
As concerns over a second wave of attacks linger, more shocking news filters through to Air Force One.
With an extraordinary piece of information on the Pentagon crash.
Our understanding is that Barbara Olson was on the plane, a frequent commentator on CNN and the wife of Solicitor General Ted Olson.
When word is broken on the media that Barbara Olson has died, Ted Olson's wife, it was the one moment where it was sort of hard to keep it together. It was so personal.
Carl Rove stares ahead with a forlorn gaze.
Most of the people who worked in the White House knew Ted Olson and Barbara Olson.
I remember Harriet Myers was a good friend of hers. And when we learned the news, with all the things going on, saw the president walk over and put his arm around Harriet to comfort her in her moment of grief.
Images show Bush hugging Harriet and walking down an aisle with his arm around her shoulders.
I went to bed that night around midnight, and there was a note on the pillow from Barbara. Ted, I love you more than I ever thought it possible to love.
Olson presses his lips together and swallows. He briefly shakes his head.
You are my best friend, lover, everything to me. Happy 61st birthday. And know that I am thinking of you as you read this. Sleep well, and I will celebrate with you on Friday. All my love, Barbara.
He looks up from a scan of the handwritten note.
Almost 9 hours after leaving Florida, and having flown over 3,000 miles, the president finally arrives at Andrews Air Force Base, just outside Washington.
Air Force One sits on the tarmac.
The routine was to get off of Air Force One, get on Marine One. There's always a sense of aura, delight. Not anymore. You could actually feel just cold, hard tension.
Bush disembarks.
There was a palpable sense of fear in the air.
An officer escorts him away.
There are two Marine ones. One is kind of the dummy one. You're supposed to not know which one the president's on. I was on the second one, and I wanted a sign that said, no, he's on the other one.
Two helicopters fly in near opposite directions.
We'd fly at treetop level, zigzagging, because it would be harder for a Stinger missile to find us, I guess. And we zigzag, and we go down to the Potomac River, and you see the smoke billowing out of the Pentagon.
A montage shows empty streets.
It was a surreal moment because the Capitol was vacant, except for military checkpoints on major thoroughfares. And the Pentagon was smoldering in the background. And it was a war zone. And it's an image I'll never forget. Man, I was a wartime president, and I was heading into the zone.
An aerial view shows the building's charred facade.
The president looks out his window, and he said, the mightiest building in the world is on fire. That's the 21st century war you just witnessed. He said it out loud to no one in particular. He was collecting his thoughts.
Marine One descends toward the White House.
This was a different kind of war. In the past, America had fought war against nation states that had a capital, they had armies, standing armies or navies. In this case, we're at war with a shadow state.
6:56 p.m., the White House, Washington, D.C.
The president and I had talked about him addressing the nation that night. Well, I just remember him feeling like it looked like he was just, you know, being chased around the country, and that that did not project the strength and reassurance that, that people needed. And so he was frustrated by that.
Bush strides across the lawn.
The president needs to move forward in a determined fashion to deal with the enemy.
Later, Bush and his team of officials work on a speech.
When you speak from the Oval Office, it's a big deal. You know, we started working on it pretty quickly.
Presidential addresses to the nation typically have a little bit more time, you know, days to be put together, and this had to be done in hours.
Karen Hughes holds a conversation with Rice.
There were pretty tense moments getting ready for the address to the nation. Clearly tired and stressed out, people trying to figure out what the next steps were.
This was the first attack on the territory, the sovereign homeland territory of the United States since the War of 1812. I felt very much that we had indeed seen the face of evil. And any moment, it looked as if there might be another attack.
The country was still in shock, and there was a real struggle or tension about, is it reassurer-in-chief or commander-in-chief? Do we need to start hitting the war drums?
You know, the speech had, I think at the beginning, had a little bit more reassurance than he wanted, and he wanted a little bit more steel, which is what it got.
President basically has to set the tone, and George Bush did. He knew what he wanted. The changes were necessary to avoid what happened to us on 9/11, to minimize the risk.
The job of a president is to protect the American people from harm. Some presidents don't need to worry about that, and some do. And it turns out I was one that did.
Bush sits behind the ornate desk at the Oval Office, eyes closed and fingers interlocked.
It was very emotional for me to see the president coming back into the Oval Office. He was different. He was a war president.
Bush slaps his palm down upon the desk and removes an insect.
Yes, why?
1 minute. I remember thinking, gosh, I was in that office, the Oval Office, 3 days ago, and wow, the curtains are the same. Carpet is the same. Nothing's the same.
The broadcast begins.
Good evening. Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts. The victims were in airplanes or in their offices, secretaries, businessmen and women, military and federal workers, moms and dads, friends and neighbors.
There were certain things that we felt he had to say immediately, things that he wouldn't get a second chance to say. And the Bush doctrine, if you harbor a terrorist, will treat you as a terrorist, was one of those things. We understood that this was bold, that it had implications. And so I took the sentence out and took it to him and I said, "Do you want to say this?" And he said, "Yes, I have to say it now."
The search is underway for those who are behind these evil acts. I've directed the full resources of our intelligence and law enforcement communities to find those responsible and to bring them to justice. We will make no distinction between the terrorist who committed these acts and those who harbor them.
The inclusion of the Bush Doctrine in the president's speech was an open question in the minutes before the speech was given, because it's a very big deal for the United States to announce that if you're harboring terrorism, you are now an enemy of the United States.
Killing thousands of Americans, more than we lost at Pearl Harbor. This was an act of war. I was a guilty party. I wanted to be as aggressive as necessary in order to achieve our objective, and that was to keep the country safe.
Of course we all were hurting. We all were terrified. War is not something you want to get into if you can avoid it. But we tend to be an aggressive nation, especially when we have been aggressed against.
When I'm asked about some of the things we did with speed, I want to say to people, what would you have done? We didn't have time for a lot of consultation about how we were going to handle it.
Rescue teams work at night.
None of us will ever forget this day. Yet we go forward to defend freedom and all that is good and just in our world. Thank you. Good night. And God bless America.
Nobody knew then where this was going to end up. But one way or another, we were going into battle as a nation.
Ash coats the suits of firefighters.
How, where, and what that would be, how long it would take, how big or how small the effort would be, were the things that nobody knew.
Teams with spades and flashlights clear rubble.
We did everything we knew to do. But 3,000 people died on your watch. Did we miss something? Could we have connected the dots better? It just gnaws at you. And you can never quite get over it because by definition, you didn't do enough. The attack took place.
A hole gapes through a truck's windshield.
You know, I've thought about it a lot. If there's something more we could have done, I'd like somebody to point it out to me, what it is. I mean, you can only act on the intelligence you got. There was a one-time vague mention of terrorists using airplanes, but it was not actionable intelligence.
Photographers snap pictures of Bush at his desk.
Okay, thank you very much.
An official ushers them away.
All right. Sad day.
Bush sips from a water bottle as he leaves the Oval Office. Lights from lighting equipment go off. September 14th, 2001. Members of FEMA, the NYPD, and state police escort the president to Marine One.
After the longest 3 days of his presidency, George Bush flies into downtown Manhattan to see for himself the scene of devastation for the first time.
Two choppers fly through the smog.
As we approach New York, probably 8 miles out, and the smoke was blowing south. And the cabin of that helicopter became filled with this awful, awful smell. You know, burnt plastic, burnt rubber, and
he shrugs.
Human bodies.
They circle the collapsed buildings.
No one says a word, and the pilot of Marine One circles that pillar of smoke. And we can look down and see the rescue workers. And then we go over and we land down by Wall Street.
Bush salutes a uniformed officer and shakes his hand.
We were the first group that had been down to Ground Zero, other than emergency services personnel.
A tattered piece of framework from one of the towers stands silhouetted against a hazy gray backdrop.
It was almost like Pompeii. A sandwich cart abandoned, covered with this dust. Sandwiches still in it. Meals still sitting on tables from several days before. It was just like everything had been frozen in time.
Two lone workers stand amidst a pile of rubble rising away into the distance.
You know, it was like going into hell. There was a fog, there was a stench of death. You know, sloshing through water. It was really, really overpowering.
Rudy Giuliani and Hillary Clinton accompany Bush at Ground Zero as he takes in the scene of devastation around them.
After we left Ground Zero, we went to the Jacob Javits Center, and we stop. The Secret Service opens the door, and President gets out. An advance man is there. The President says, "What's this?" We've gathered some of the families of the policemen and firemen and emergency workers that are missing down at Ground Zero. We thought you could say something to them.
Bush holds a man in a tight embrace.
It was unbelievably disheartening in many ways because there were families who were waiting for their loved ones to come out of the rubble. And I had just seen the rubble and knew that nobody was coming out.
A little girl points at a photograph.
And so my job there was to provide comfort as best as I could to people who hoped for the impossible. The last person I saw was Arlene Howard. Arlene held this badge.
An older woman sits in a chair.
Her son, George, was off duty that day, but when things started rolling, he showed up, got put on his uniform, and went into those buildings and died. And she took the badge from his corpse, from his dead body, and gave it to the President of the United States and said, I want you to always remember.
Arlene Howard clasps Bush's hand.
It meant never forget. Never forget the victims. You know, it took 20 years for the date to become, you know, meaningless to a lot of people. And yet to the people that went through it, it's not. And that badge reminds us it's not a meaningless date. Personally, I think it strengthened my faith. And certainly strengthened my faith in the American people because I saw America at its best.
A still shows Bush facing away, his arms around two people. Cut to black. Words appear. 2,977 people were killed in the terrorist attacks on 9/11. On May 2, 2011, U.S. Navy SEALs shot dead Osama bin Laden, leader of Al-Qaeda. The terror attacks led to the 20-year conflict in Afghanistan, America's longest war. In memory of the victims of the 9/11 attacks, water flows down the reflecting pools of the 9/11 memorial in New York. Fade to black. Credits appear. Producer-director Adam Wishart. Credits continue. 404-750-1001. Devon Atlantic Limited is the author of this cinematographic or audiovisual work for the purposes of Article 15(2) of the Berne Convention and all national laws giving effect thereto. Copyright Apple Video Programming, LLC, 2021. All rights reserved. This film has been described by Pixelogic Media, voiced by Darren Revitz. Wish Art Films, co-produced with BBC. Apple TV+.